Whistleblowers accuse the Department of Justice of acting under political influence.
Two DOJ attorneys testified today before a House panel. One of them alleges that the president's friend Roger Stone got preferential treatment.
I'm David Greene with Rachel Martin, and this is Up First from NPR News. After a disappointing rally in Tulsa over the weekend, President Trump riled up crowds in Arizona with some now familiar gambits. But as the election approaches, will Trump stick to large indoor rallies despite the raging pandemic?
You begin to rethink, okay, what do we need to tweak? What do we need to do different?
And finally, it's going to look a little different, but baseball is back. Spring training kicks off in July, and the season will consist of just 60 games. How will players stay safe? Stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your day.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. Capital One's assistant Eno sends alerts about credit card accounts. Visit CapitalOne.com/Eno. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Support also comes from NPR sponsor Facebook. It's a challenging time for small businesses across the country. Facebook's Business Resource Hub offers free tools to help manage your business and support customers and employees. Learn more at Facebook.com/resource.
Does political pressure influence the decision-making at the Justice Department? Two whistleblowers who will testify on Capitol Hill today say yes.
Right. So one of the two DOJ lawyers, Aaron Zielinski, says he heard that President Trump's longtime political advisor, Roger Stone, received preferential treatment because of his relationship with the president. And then a second DOJ attorney, John Elias, is planning to tell House lawmakers about his concerns with antitrust investigations launched under Attorney General William Barr. Now, Barr earlier this year, we should say, told ABC News that part of his job is to make sure there is no political interference.
I think the essential role of the Attorney General is to keep law enforcement, the criminal process, sacrosanct, to make sure there is no political interference in it.
NPR's national justice correspondent, Carrie Johnson, has seen part of what they will say, and she joins us now. Hi, Carrie.
Good morning, Rachel, and sorry about the dog.
Yeah, no worries. We love dogs. So let's talk more about that Roger Stone case. What does Aaron Zielinski say happened there?
Yeah, he's a lawyer who's worked at the Justice Department for about 6 years. He says that he never before in his career saw anybody receive preferential treatment because of politics until the Roger Stone case. He says he heard from people in the office that Stone received favorable treatment because of his relationship to the president, and that a higher up in the U.S. Attorney's Office here in D.C. was receiving heavy pressure. In part, he was worried, the higher up in the U.S. Attorney's Office, because he was afraid of the president and what the president might say or do if they didn't try to reduce a punishment recommendation for Roger Stone.
Hmm. Okay, so that's what we're expected to hear from one of two DOJ whistleblowers. David mentioned the other one, John Elias. He's going to allege something about antitrust investigations. What can you tell us there?
John Elias has worked at the Justice Department for much longer than Aaron Zielinski. He's worked in leadership roles in the antitrust division for presidents who are Democrats and also Republicans. And he says he's noticed in this administration, the Trump administration, that they've opened antitrust investigations in at least two sets of cases that seem to be improper. One involves an investigation of 10 marijuana businesses. He said that Attorney General Bill Barr didn't like the marijuana industry, and so the department opened an investigation, even though there was no real valid basis to do so. And another investigation in antitrust was opened 4 days after the president tweeted his displeasure about an agreement that the state of California had reached with four automakers about emission standards. Both those investigations were closed with no action. Elias says politics was involved.
So, Carrie, these two attorneys are still at the DOJ. Is that going to affect what they can and can't say?
Yeah, I want to emphasize how unusual, how really rare it is for attorneys at this level in the Justice Department who are still working there to testify on Capitol Hill. This almost never happens. The Justice Department has a policy against it. I do expect that there may be some objections by the Justice Department in the middle of some of this testimony today. But as Aaron Zielinski has noted in his opening statement, that there are reasons why he can answer some questions and can't answer others. But if the department is hoping to avoid embarrassment, he says he can still answer those questions today.
In just a couple seconds, Carrie, has the attorney general said anything about the accusations?
The attorney general spokesman says that this is hearsay and that he stands behind his comments that politics does not influence any business at the Justice Department.
NPR's Carrie Johnson for us. Carrie, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thousands of young conservatives were shoulder to shoulder inside a megachurch in Phoenix yesterday. They were there to see President Trump.
Who are the people that stood up? I just want to stand up, please. Who said, I love you? Whoa!
Yeah, so for about 90 minutes, they were cheering, they were yelling. And even though coronavirus cases in the city are on the rise, they were mostly not wearing face masks. This comes after that rally on Saturday night in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where people just didn't show up in the numbers that had been expected. Large sections of that arena were left empty. And all this has the Trump campaign reassessing what his rallies are going to look like going forward.
We've got NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith with us this morning. Hi, Tam.
Good morning.
What are you hearing from the people in President Trump's orbit about that Tulsa rally and what it means for the campaign?
A White House official described it to me as an unforced error and a self-inflicted wound. The campaign underestimated how many people may be nervous to attend an indoor rally in the middle of a pandemic with protests outside. And they overhyped expected attendance. I spoke with Congressman Tom Cole from Oklahoma. He's a Republican. He flew on Air Force One to and from the rally. And he said the campaign is working to adjust to a new reality with coronavirus and those protests.
They'll get better. I mean, it's like anything else. You haven't done it for 3-4 months. This is your first trip back. You begin to rethink, okay, what do we need to tweak? What do we need to do different?
And he described the president's rally speech as like seeing something off Broadway, and it'll be more like Broadway later. He said the president needs to do a better job of describing what his second term agenda would be and actually landing some punches on his opponent, Joe Biden.
So what did he say? I mean, in Arizona, the venue was smaller than we saw in Tulsa, but it was packed. Did President Trump change his message at all in Arizona?
No, he really brought back a lot of the material from the Tulsa rally Saturday. In some ways, those rallies are like a focus group for President Trump. And when he sees something that he thinks is working, he keeps bringing it back. And an indication that he thought one thing is working is that he brought that back, this riff where he used an offensive term to describe the coronavirus.
It's got all different names. Wuhan. Wuhan was catching on. Coronavirus, right? Kung flu, yeah.
Maybe you could hear the crowd sort of egging him on to say it again. And I should say that that wasn't technically a campaign rally there in Phoenix. It was put on by a group called Turning Point, which is basically a Trump fan club for young people.
So, I mean, Tom Cole, we heard him say, hey, they might need to adjust this whole inside rally thing. But it's one thing for Tom Cole to say it. It's quite another for the Trump campaign or the president himself. I mean, are they going to keep going with these rallies?
Well, the communications director said in a statement that President Trump is eager to keep hitting the campaign trail, but he didn't answer questions about what rallies might look like going forward. There are a lot of ideas floating around. Republican strategist Ron Bongean suggested the campaign return to what worked for Trump in 2016, rallies in airport hangars.
You're going to allow a few thousand people in. They're going to be able to deliver that image of enthusiasm while the president stands, you know, on a stage with this plane in the background. It's a great backdrop. It signifies, you know, momentum and strength.
Basically, outdoors, remote to keep protesters at bay, and no seats that could turn up empty.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Thanks, Tam.
You're welcome.
David, my friend, there is good news, finally. Baseball's back.
So happy. I really need some baseball. I know there are a lot of risks, but I really need some baseball. Hopefully they can do this safely. So Major League Baseball and its players union, they announced yesterday that they have reached this agreement to play a season. It's a shortened season, 60 games. Players are going to report for spring training by July 1st. Opening day scheduled for July 23rd or 24th. These disagreements over money and safety had delayed the return of America's pastime.
Indeed. So NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman has been following the story, joins us now. Hi, Tom.
Following and following and following. Good morning.
So much following. Good morning. What's it going to look like? What are these games going to be?
A sprint. Rachel, you know, baseball normally is a marathon, 162 games from spring to the front edges of winter. Now, 60-game schedule, which the union still has to review. Games are largely going to be against division foes. They're regionally close, so that cuts down on travel. For the first time since 1973, when designated hitters started batting for pitchers in the American League, now there will be a designated hitter in the National League, too. Mm. Extra inning games will start with a runner on second base. That's a little leaguish, don't you think? But this is a health and safety measure to prevent super long games. Teams don't want a bunch of exhausted players with the season jammed into a very short schedule.
Right. And also, I know it's controversial. As a fan, I'm all about the shorter baseball game, to be perfectly honest, and shorter season. You know, don't at me. Okay, so why did this take so long, Tom?
We're going to check back with you. There were long and acrimonious negotiations over money and the number of games to be played. Players wanted more games so they could make more money because their salaries were already going to be greatly reduced, and owners wanted fewer games. After all that time of back and forth, the two sides never agreed. Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred unilaterally imposed this season. He had the power to do that. So players are going back to work. They're not overjoyed, and they might file a grievance to try to reclaim up to $1 billion in pay.
What are the costs and the benefits of the shorter season?
Well, you actually start with every team having a chance. If they can put together a hot streak in a very short regular season, conversely, a slow-starting team won't have time to rebound. Exhibit A, Rachel, the Washington Nationals last year. After 50 games, they were 19-31. Of course, their surge from that point is now legendary. They went on to win the World Series.
Go Nats! So what's the sport expecting to hear from its fans besides me about all this?
Some are thrilled, like you sound. Sports fans are very good at forgiving and forgetting and just getting caught up in the games. Others are angry about the players and owners battling while the world has been fraying with a pandemic, protests in the streets, huge unemployment. And it's left some fans saying a pox on both your houses to players and owners.
NPR's Tom Goldman. We appreciate it, Tom. Thank you.
You are welcome.
And that is Up First for this Wednesday, June 24th. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. We hope you come back here and listen tomorrow. And we know that the news is not over when this podcast is over. So you can follow us on Twitter. We are at Up First. We'll give you a daily roundup of the most important stories of the day.
And did you know? There's a really easy way to explore the vast world of public radio shows and podcasts. It's called NPR One. Hear news from the station in your community, stories from around the country, and podcast suggestions based on what you like. Download NPR One at the App Store.
Actress Tracee Ellis Ross is used to people talking about her age a lot, and she's okay with whatever people say.
I'm 47 years old, and I'm the most comfortable in my skin I've ever been. What, when we go back to being 22? No, thank you.
The Black-ish star on Confronting an Ageist World. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.